From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Yeah, we will have a media project. We will. And we are happy to be underway with you today. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, and we thank you for joining us. Here with me today, Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus, a man who long ago, for a long time, I should say, ran the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Long ago in a faraway place.
Not so either way. Judy Patrick of the New York Press Association, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady.
Yeah, I'm always glad to be here, Rex.
Well, it's just wonderful to see you.
Wait. Give that another view after the show's over.
Yeah. See if you still feel that way. Kaylin Brown, head of the Department of Communication at the Communications with S at the College of St. Rose.
Hello.
There she is.
Ready to communicate.
Ready to communicate. She is communicating. And we're the Media Project. Alan is out as we tape, so we will be making our way along without Dr. Shartok, and we'll see if we can give you some insight notwithstanding. As we look back over the last couple of weeks, obviously the dominant news has involved the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Kavanaugh. And it's really worth assessing how the media has handled this very controversial issue in which the nation seems to be significantly divided. Two-thirds of voters say this could be a voting issue for them in the fall. There is seemingly a significant partisan divide on this. And it seems, if you look at the commentary on cable television, that there's been a divide in the way it's been handled. So any general assessments of how this has gone?
Well, you know, if we're going to judge amount and kinds of coverage based on what's on cable television, we run the risk of forgetting what the rest of the media landscape is. But because cable television is so dominant, it's hard to ignore. And as is typically the case with cable television, whether it's the story or whether it's a missing airliner or whether whatever the news of the day is, they are just going to run with it all of the time, perhaps understandably so, because they have different programs on and not everybody is watching all the time. But if you do nothing but watch cable news, it's coming out of your ears and I believe disproportionately covered.
Yeah, it's the melodrama, I think, of cable news that distorts our frame of reference when we're dealing with this very important issue. We don't look at the real issues at play here about women's role in society and people's reaction to sexual harassment allegations. The other thing I found really interesting is how the words people are using. We're hearing the word accuser rather than a woman who maintains that she's been the victim of sexual assault.
Very good point. In so many instances, we are being encouraged as journalists to use person-first language, like a person is not an addict. It's a person. Rather, we describe someone in that situation as a person who has used drugs. And that's very interesting. Instead of calling her an accuser...
The accuser.
The accuser, yes. That's shorthand. You could just as easily say a woman who said she was sexually assaulted, right?
I know that doesn't fit in a headline, but right. That might be more appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And it's important that we're thinking about the words that reporters and editors are using, because those words, which I say a lot, matter. This conversation is reminding me of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was adopted back in the 90s. And in the reporting world, we used to use wheelchair bound when we talked about people who use wheelchairs. But when the ADA came around, then we changed the language to say someone who uses a wheelchair, mm-hmm. The same person first kind of language. So it seems like that's moving forward when the media is deciding how to name things.
I thought the most interesting media decision, journalistic decision, and stop me if I've got any of these facts wrong, but the story that the New Yorker ran on the second victim or mm-hmm. accuser, and the New York Times, which was on the story but chose not to use the story, the New York Times believing that it did not have enough to go with the story, having essentially the same information that the New Yorker had, and the New Yorker did go with the story.
Right.
I have that right?
The article by, yes, the article by Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer, who, you know, have written significant, I mean, their bylines carry credibility, and it's an important factor. The decision by The New Yorker had to do with the fact that she was willing to come forward to speak specifically, I think, personally. And the Times decision was made in a somewhat different time context. I think The New Yorker had a little more time to develop it and therefore got a little bit deeper into the story. Am I remembering that correctly?
Exactly. And The New Yorker had the ability to talk to the woman who was making these claims. The New York Times didn't have access to that woman, and that was a key part of the story. It was interesting that the conservatives, or those who are very strong advocates for Brett Kavanaugh, tried to turn that into the fact that the New York Times didn't think this was a credible story. That was not what was happening there. They just didn't have enough to run the story.
All of a sudden, they liked the failing New York Times.
Exactly.
But it was actually about the New York Times doing its job and recognizing they couldn't confirm the story. And when the Times couldn't confirm the story, that was the end of that. They couldn't choose to publish a story they couldn't confirm.
Right. It sounds like it's a little different from the controversy with Ronan Farrow's story and NBC, the story that he broke that they wouldn't publish, you know, earlier. That seems to have been an NBC cold feet decision.
Well, they claim they didn't have enough, but the same amount that they had was ultimately published elsewhere. So, but I think to Judy's point, the New York Times never said the story wasn't true,
right?
Contrary to what the conservatives say they did. They just said, we don't have enough to go with on this story. And had they had the interview with the accuser, they probably would have run the story.
And one of the difficult things that emerges is that once a story like this is published by The New Yorker, it becomes a part of the conversation. It becomes newsworthy in itself. We put that story on the front page of the Times Union, and I had an attack from a reader who said, you published a story that the New York Times didn't think was good enough. Even the left-wing New York Times wouldn't publish it, and yet you did. But of course, the story is out there, and it becomes a part of the news. Even if you didn't think that the New Yorker had enough content to publish, it becomes an element worth publishing in this context.
By the way, you know that the joke going around is that the last thing that a CEO wants to hear is his secretary buzzing him in and saying Ronan Farrow is on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it used to be Mike Wallace.
Yeah. It's worse now. Ronan Farrow, absolutely. You know, one of the interesting developments also was a Supreme Court nominee giving an interview in real time to a TV network, Martha McCallum of Fox News did the interview. She's, by the way, an upstate product, a graduate of St. Lawrence University. I just passed that along.
She did a fine job with that interview.
She
thoughtful and measured, and she asked probing questions. I thought that she asked questions that were relevant, and she didn't let the judge off the hook. I thought she conducted herself professionally and like a true middle-of-the-road reporter with no bias, bias.
Which probably surprised Kavanaugh and his handlers, because I'm sure that they felt they were getting to a safe haven at Fox News.
Absolutely. That's why he was positioned at Fox.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of blowback here, too. Oh, how dare a Supreme Court nominee go out in the public and talk to a reporter? I didn't have a problem with that. I think that they should be more available. I don't think it demeans the court for potential justices to talk to reporters, to get more out about who they are and what they're doing. Of course, this was a controlled setting and there was a motive behind this, but I think the interview process for Supreme Court nominees needs to allow more probing by the news media.
Yes. Interestingly, though, of course, what she didn't ask, because it wasn't the context of the interview, and what he would not have answered would have been anything about his judgment about legal issues. The same questions that he wouldn't answer for senators during the confirmation hearing, she wouldn't even ask him because we know we're not going to get a real answer. So it was not at all illuminating about what kind of a judge he would be on legal issues if he's on the Supreme Court. He was only limited to the very narrow area of what happened then? What are your opinions now in saying that this did not happen?
I would imagine we've all had the same experience, whether it's the Supreme Court, which we have not had the experience, but when we've interviewed county court candidates, city court candidates, they are very quiet on any kinds of opinions regarding judicial matters. And it makes it virtually impossible for us as an editorial board to assess them. And I don't know how the voters assess them other than looking at what the initial is next to their name. Is it either R, C, or D?
Or the extensive case law and precedents they set, and that requires a
homework.
Very legally tuned mind that can vet through precedent-setting cases and determine what the judge ruled and why. Mm-hmm. And that's exhaustive work, which is why I believe DAs around the country were asked to pitch in and help do research on behalf of the Justice Department when they were vetting him.
Yeah, news media only gets to find out whether they're qualified or unqualified, which does not seem like a good amount of information to give the voters before they go to the polls.
If you're wishing to share your point of view about this, media@wamc.org, we're always happy to get your thoughts. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Kaylin Brown, and Rex Smith, we are the projectors of the Media Project this week, that kind of thing. By the way, one of the questions that Martha McCallum did not ask, which she might have, is press him a little bit on his relationship with Mark Judge, the friend who was supposedly present at the assault that occurred in high school, according to the accusation. Mark Judge, who, by the way, a Washington Post reporter found, quote, holed up in the house of a longtime friend in Bethany Beach, nearly 3 hours from D.C. Good reporting.
Good. And she also looked in the car, saw an envelope with his name on it, and saw a big stack of Superman comics. Interesting.
And he asked her, how did you find me?
How did you find me?
Because she did her job.
Good reporter. Absolutely. It's a good thing. I mean, that is a key thing. I mean, it seems to me that one of the key elements that the media has done a better job of than the Congress is trying to ferret out what's going on here with Mark Judge, who wrote a book about his heavy drinking, his blacking out while drinking, in which there was a main character, his wingman, whose name quite conveniently was Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was not at all explored by the senators. You know, one of the things that's most interesting about the controversy about the Supreme Court is the extent to which people, of course, view this through the lens of their own experience. And we have all had the experience of dealing with readers, listeners, viewers who come to us and accuse us of bias. Very interesting new study out into the question of where bias complaints come from. And it has to do with this, that those who are most distrustful of the news media, those most likely to accuse the media of bias, tend to be the most biased readers. Now, I guess this is not surprising, but we now have research that suggests that rather than having so much bias in the news media, there is actually bias on the part of those who are receiving the news.
This was a fascinating study that people should check out. One of the reasons that they think that people demonstrate high level of bias is that they habitually consume highly biased news, and that distorts their frame of reference. They found, for example, people who regularly listen to Rush Limbaugh tended to be more biased than others. Also, MSNBC, those listeners or that audience tends to be more biased. We should give a shout out to NPR and the Wall Street Journal. Those news sources had the least biased consumers.
What's really interesting about this study is that it mirrored scholarly research where they did blind reviewing, so that when they presented the group, the cohort of people that they were studying, were presented with news articles without the origin of the news article, and readers did not know where they were getting this news from, they were more likely to be accepting of the content more so when they did not know where it came from, on both left-leaning and right-leaning readers. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that people were more accepting of content if they did not know where it had come from.
I loved the study's link to the way that symphony orchestras audition players. I had an interesting conversation a little bit ago with David Allen Miller, the conductor of the Albany Symphony Orchestra, who had just the day that I was chatting with him about this auditioned something like 30 tuba players. Imagine that.
Oh. That's an interesting job, auditioning
what
tuba
a day.
Players.
How about that? But, you know, you put them behind a screen so you can't see who it is. And the people, if you're joined by a great tuba player, that person, that tuba player will think they can tell who it is. Or the same thing is true, of course, cello or viola, anything.
Why would they put them behind a screen?
So that there is less of a chance of bias. That actually goes
gender
to the
bias.
Point of this. In this case,
sorry.
It was gender bias, yeah. That if you put someone behind a screen when you're auditioning, the share of women admitted to city orchestras increases substantially if they can't tell that it's a woman player. And so this is now the norm for the auditioning of orchestras, to have the players behind a screen. So it would make sense that if you could give people type or video with no Chiron on it, so you can't tell the source. See if the bias is as relevant, or see if it comes through as much as you think it does. kind of amazing. Now, Alan, if he were here, would say, well, I can always tell. See, I can quote him because I've been doing the show so many years.
Yes, we've heard it all.
You can always tell where the story's from,
well,
right?
You can tell the difference between the New York Times and the New York Post. Of course you can. I mean, that is, the language is very different there. It's not simply a matter of the political bias that it comes from, but it is the nature of the way it's presented also. But certainly, in the context of reporting, the notion that readers, and it only makes sense, we all bring to every experience we have the full range of our own experiences, and so it would make sense that our biases would influence the way we see it. But you know,
but I think that in part explains why the press is distrusted and why our favorability ratings are not high. I mean, I'll take a very benign example. You all have examples of your own. I can remember when I started out in sports and I would cover a football game between two local rivals and tried to write the story right up the middle. I would get feedback from both sides saying that I favored the other side when the intent was to do neither. But if you go into reading that story with your bias being in favor of one side and your story doesn't match that bias, then it's the newspaper's fault. They're a biased reporter.
Now, as a former sports writer, tell me this, Ira. Isn't it true that if you're writing sports for about a home team, you really need to have a bias in favor of the home team, don't you? Or don't your readers hate it?
Yes, the readers hate it. If you don't, I would contend that you shouldn't do it that way. But I suspect, and that the experience that most local reporters have is that they take the point of view of the home team. But I hope that's less common than I think it is. But that was certainly not my approach, which is one of the reasons I was hated by both sides.
when we're in the classroom and we talk about bias, we talk about, for instance, birth order. So are you a first child, a last child, an only child, a middle child? That influences how you make decisions. Because just for an example, you know, what faith were you raised in? Was there a faith in your family? Was there no faith in your family? All of that equates with the biases. And when you're coming up reporter to be, you don't even recognize sometimes that all of that has fed into mm-hmm. the decisions you make about, this is the source I'm going to use first in my story. This is the source I'm going to use second. Someone has to be first to start the story. Ergo, you get a bias.
Hmm. You know, at the conclusion of the study, they mentioned that if you habitually consume higher quality news, you tend to be less biased. I know that, and the higher quality news tends to be newspapers. Just saying.
And I think everybody at this table would agree.
Well, there you go. I'll tell you, I had limited experience as a sports writer, but when I was the editor of a small newspaper around at a little county seat town in the Midwest, there came a time, we covered three different school districts, and the two guys who ordinarily would be covering sports were occupied covering the team on the north end and the team in the south end that were actually better than the home team from our community. So I had to go cover the first game of the season, an away game for the high school team of the Rensselaer, Indiana Central High School Bombers. And the Bombers went off and they lost 48-0. And I had to write about the home team losing 48-0. And let me tell you, every first down becomes a paragraph of its own. In that case, you know, Rensselaer threatened on the 45-yard line.
I can one-up you. I was covering Kingston High School playing Poughkeepsie High School in Poughkeepsie.
Oh,
now,
boy.
When you're a local football reporter, there most of the time is no press box. So what you do is you walk along the sidelines mm-hmm. taking your notes. And the Kingston people thought I was biased against Kingston. So this particular game, I walked the Poughkeepsie sideline. Kingston's fans were all the way on the other side of the field. And Kingston scored a touchdown. And one of the leather lungs who I knew from Kingston, I could hear him across the field.
Hey,
Ira, what'd you think of that? And that's the life of a high school football in a small town.
Oh, boy, wouldn't want to have to do it. All right, let's talk about something that you don't see much of in the media and see why that is. And that is, there are two things that I tell people we don't publish in the Times Union. Fiction, intentionally. And poetry. Now, there's a good reason for this. The time you publish a first poem from a reader, you're going to then be deluged with poetry. And I do not feel qualified to judge what is good and what is not in terms of poetry. And, you know, we have a limited amount of space. But I'm just wondering if maybe a little fiction wouldn't be a bad thing in terms of building reader interest. I mean, after all, this is how Charles Dickens was published.
Exactly, and it would be a way to keep people getting into the habit of reading the newspaper. It's something that when I was at the Gazette, we considered doing it. The question is getting good quality content and making sure it comes every week. But again, this has been a tradition in newspapers. Back in the day, they did run serial kind of fiction pieces, which really grabbed the attention of readers and boosted circulation.
And after all, comics aren't, I mean, I hate to break it to you, but comics are not true.
Beetle Bailey!
What about Doonesbury? But the reason you're raising this is because there's a newspaper in Washington State that is running serialized fiction.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
The Inlander,
and they're paying a guy $10,000 for a series that's going to run weekly for a whole year. It looks like a great piece, and I can almost imagine it, and I'm just wondering if it might not be a worthwhile thing for us to consider, or especially these days, graphic novels. You know, this is a growing genre, which is really interesting. That is kind of comic books for adults, if you will. And maybe that is something that we should consider in trying to reshape the role of the print media, at least. I don't know that we necessarily need fiction on the digital side of things, but maybe this would be something that would build readership. I'd be interested to hear. Remember that, folks, media@wamc.org. Be interested to hear what people think about that idea.
Yeah, well, what is it going to cost us if we decide to do it? Are we running excerpts from books to help sell a book and we get the content for a while, or are we actually taking a reporter or hiring somebody to do this at the same time that we're not hiring and, in fact, letting go people who are covering news? So it's a determination that may have made more sense to me when times were better. Then again, when times were better, you didn't need serialized content to sell newspaper.
And the other thing is you have to make sure you really clearly label it as fiction, because people get confused, especially online.
That's the issue when the student journalists ask us, could we run poetry or could we run fiction? And I'm the advisor to the school paper, and I frequently say our space is too precious to place it somewhere else. We have too many stories to cover, mm-hmm. too much serious stuff going on that needs time devoted to it, to spend time with poetry and fiction in the newspaper. It is a newspaper. Not that it's paper online still, it's a newspaper. And if you could compromise the credibility of the publication. That's just my one concern, though. I do agree with Judy. I see value in creating reading habits and maybe getting some people in through a fiction. It's a tough call. I don't envy an editor for having to make that call.
And finally today, we turn to the topic of media access. We've complained before about access to the governor of New York. And of course, now the president also. President Trump actually conducted his first, I think his fourth since he was elected, full-scale press conference. A remarkable show it was.
Wow, wasn't it, though?
But there is, you know, there used to be something called the daily White House press briefing, sometimes two a day, which has gone away in this administration. Sometimes there's only one press briefing a week, and there seems to be a lack of availability. Organizations, news organizations that are somewhat smaller, like ours, for example, Hearst has Washington correspondents, but we're not like the New York Times or the networks, always right there on the White House lawn. The White House press briefing has often been valuable. This administration simply isn't doing it. You don't see Sarah Huckabee Sanders up there every day the way you used to see the White House press secretary.
They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. Kaylin Brown is chair of the Department of Communication at the College of St. Rose. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org, or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants.